is to the conformal anomaly. Okay, and it's very, very similar. So the basic overview is that in order to have an effective field theory, you usually, following the Wilson-like prescription, expand effective action and local invariance. And if you think about what you're really doing here, you're assuming that the short and long distance physics decouples in some sort of reasonably clean way that you can systematize by the scaling dimensions of operators in the effective action with the right symmetries. But as I tried to convince you yesterday, massless modes are very special and don't quite fit into this scheme in the sense that anomalies are really a way for the short distance and long distance physics to leak into each other. And basically, it depends on which way you look at it, but there's definitely long distance, or more strictly speaking, light cone physics associated with anomalies. And that's what the point about this massless poles was yesterday. So what this means ultimately is that there are particular terms that are non-local in the original invariance. Yesterday we were talking about the field strength. Today we'll be talking about the curvature invariance, but that can be made local with the introduction of an additional scalar field, and that scalar field or pseudo-scalar field in the chiral case is actually a bona fide propagating degree of freedom. It basically inheriting its dynamics from the underlying field theory that gave rise to the anomaly. So to see where we're going with this, this can be important in gravity, particularly in situations where you have very large redshifts or blue shifts, because that's the situation in which it's very important to keep track of short distance and long distance degrees of freedom at the same time. And basically they can talk to each other just kinematically. And that's really why this is relevant, I think, relevant in a technical sense in terms of scaling dimensions, but relevant in a more common physical sense of just producing large effects possibly in physics of horizons. So let's start again with the simpler case of two dimensions, and that should be familiar to most people. It was well studied in the 80s and 90s in particular. So if you were to write down the local action in two dimensions, you would write down all the invariants up to dimension two and classify everything higher as irrelevant in the infrared. But this has no local degrees of freedom at all in two dimensions because the scalar curvature is a total derivative, can be written as a total derivative, which means that the variation of this action is not going to produce any dynamics. It's actually overconstrained. Or another way to look at it is that in two dimensions, all the only metric degree of freedom you can have at all is the conformal part of the metric, because all metrics are locally conformally flat up to topological terms. So that would be the end of the story if you were to take the ordinary counting of local invariants. There would be no 2D gravity at all. However, there is a conformal anomaly, namely if I put massless fields into a general curved background and calculate the stress energy tensor, demanding that the tensor be conserved. So again, the anomaly, as we said yesterday, is generally speaking a clash of symmetries. When you try to maintain more than one symmetry, you find out you can't. And we'll go to the one loop diagram that shows that simply in the conformal case. And so we keep conservation because we want to maintain the equivalence principle, but there's no reason to, in general, maintain conformal invariance, so we give up conformal invariance, and then there's a well-defined anomaly in the trace of the energy-momentum tensor, which is proportional to the curvature, Ricci scalar curvature of the background. And this is the only dimension two operator that can appear here. The coefficient is just the number of scalar or fermion fields that are in the conformal theory on the underlying quantum field theory. Now, from this, one can immediately obtain an effective action, right? Because the trace of the energy momentum tensor up to a factor of square root of g is nothing else than the variation with respect to the conformal part of the metric. So I can think of this as a variation with respect to sigma. If I put this formula for r in here, this is a linear function of sigma. So once again, as yesterday, you can find the effective action just by trivially writing down a quadratic function of sigma who has that linear variation, and that's this. This is local in sigma, but of course sigma was a choice of coordinates, if you wish, a choice of conformal. I had to choose what the background metric was in order to define sigma. So that's not a completely covariant form. It depends on the background and sigma decomposition. But notice already that there is a kinetic term for sigma. So in terms of dynamics, this means that the theory, including the trace anomaly and including this effective action term, is going to have some dynamics of the scalar field, of this conformal part of the metric that it didn't have at the classical level. Now, the structure of the anomaly is that this Vestimino action, in terms of the background and the conformal factor, can be written as a difference of two completely covariant actions in terms of the metric G and the metric G bar. This is a general property of anomalies that this is basically can be expressed as the cohomology of the Weyl group, that this effective action, this Vestimino action, must be a difference of two covariant actions. Okay, in any case, you can just observe that that's the case and write down this anomaly's effective action, find out basically the manipulations are very simple. You just formally solve this linear equation for sigma, put this on the left-hand side and invert the Laplace, the wave operator in terms of its Green's function. And then you can write this immediately in this form. And so one of these terms is this one, which is now a completely covariant but non-local form of the effective action due to the anomaly. And so you traded a local non-covariant form for a non-local covariant form, which are equivalent up to boundary terms. And this can again be made local and completely covariant at the price of introducing a scalar, a phi, which is clearly closely related to sigma, but not identical to it, because this does not depend on the background. And you can write down this anomalous effective action such that the variation with respect to phi gives you the phi equation. If I solve for phi and put it back, I get the non-local effective action. So that is the trivial sort of manipulations that you can do at the functional level that shows, once again, if you haven't completely misled yourself, that there must be a new scalar degree of freedom that wasn't there at the classical level. And it's basically the collective modes of the underlying quantum field theory expressed to the anomaly and then in this one loop effective action.
Do you just ignore the S G bar?
Yeah, that's basically an integration constant. You can think of that as dependent on some fixed fiducial background, which you could take to be flat, and then it's just a constant. So in terms of the dynamical metric, it's G, not this zero point, if you wish. But you are essentially integrating over the fiber of the conformal factor, of the Weyl factor. So you can see this. So this was one way of looking at it in a general curve space, and that's a general covariant form. But you can, of course, also look at this in terms of flat space amplitudes by taking variation of this expectation value in with respect to the metric, and setting the metric then to flat, you can see that there has to be an anomaly. The anomaly has to show up in the two-point function of the TT correlator in flat space. And indeed it does, and this is the calculation, very simple and similar to the one we discussed yesterday for the chiral anomaly. So if I now just take two stress tensors instead of currents, as we were doing yesterday, and you demand conservation, so once again there's an issue of how to define this diagram, but if you demand conservation, then it has to have this tensor structure. That's the unique tensor structure in terms of a single momentum and the background flat metric that is obeying the water identities of conservation. Contraction with any of the indices gives zero. But then once you do that, you go look at the diagram and you pull out this tensor structure and you're forced to have a non-zero pi, the scalar part of this, such that k squared times pi is non-zero at k squared equals zero. In other words, if I take the trace over two of these indices, I get a factor of k squared, but that's non-zero because of the anomaly, because of this equation. Okay, it has to be non-zero because the variation with respect to the metric here produces something finite on this side. So indeed, it's correct. You find a definite coefficient in terms of this, which is just the central charge of the matter field running around the loop. And once again, you can look at the intermediate states and see that there's a correlated pair state in the intermediate state, which can be expressed as a boson. So all of these features, which we talked about in detail yesterday, carry through here again with a little bit more index manipulation. Now, once you have this effective action, and it's convenient to use it in this local form, it's equivalent to this, but this is a more convenient form, you can vary it and obtain a stress tensor, which is conserved because I've written a local covariant effective action, and here it is. It's fairly simple in this case. Notice there are quadratic terms in phi, which are naively conformal invariant. Namely, if I take the trace, I get zero, but there's also a linear term in phi, which is coming from this linear interaction with the background curvature. So you can already, here again, very simple calculations in 2D, already show you something interesting might be encoded in this effective action. So as a toy model for a black hole, consider a two-dimensional metric in which this R star is, what you would usually call the Reggie Wheeler tortoise coordinate. So here's some function F, which, I can take to be 1 minus 2m over r, not solving any Einstein equations, just take this as a background metric in 2D and ask, what does this stress tensor do in that metric background? So you have to solve the wave equation box phi equals minus r, which is the second derivative of f. And if you say, well, let's just make phi a function of r or r star, and I could add a linear term in time if I want, just to make it simple and look in a static coordinates. The general solution is this, just linear functions of r star and t, but this log f has to be there in order to satisfy the inhomogeneous equation. So this is the homogeneous solutions to box phi equals zero, and this is the particular inhomogeneous solution to this equation under this assumption. Now just stick this simple phi in here, calculate the derivatives, and you get the stress tensor components that look like this in terms of these integration constants p and q. And notice they generically involve 1 over f. And I've purposely written it in one up and one down because these components are essentially gauge invariant. They think of this tensor as a matrix in 2x2 matrix in T and R star, then you can show that these the finiteness of the tensor on this would-be horizon at R equals 2m are just controlled by these components. All have to be non-singular at f equals zero, but they generically have 1 over f terms, right? And you just see that the condition that all of these components be finite, this has to be zero, namely pq, either p or q have to be zero. P is the linear time dependence, and this combination has to cancel this one. This is regular, so p squared plus q squared equals 1. So you basically have a small number of solutions. Either p is 0 or q is 0. If p is 0, q has to be plus or minus 1, the other way around, and p equals plus or minus 1. And by the way, this gives you essentially all of the allowed states that people have discussed is a toy model in in four-dimensional black holes. P gives you the flux, which is basically telling you about Hawking radiation, and Q is by varying Q, you get the Hartle-Hawking state or the Bulwer-like state. So basically, this already contains, from these simple calculations, this already contains information about what this two-dimensional toy black hole would behave like. And you see that there can be large effects on this would-be horizon, even though that would seem to be nothing but a coordinate transformation. In terms of the talk I gave last week about large effects on the horizon, it's coming from this. You see, the fact that the phi has to be logarithmic in F, generically, and you can cancel that by choosing the homogeneous terms appropriately, but that's essentially a set of measure zero in the parameters that I can choose. So, of course, that doesn't prove that the singularity has to be there, but it shows it generically is, and with hardly any calculation at all. So instead of doing quantum field theory in curved space, modes, and all of that renormalization program, I basically get everything just by studying classical equations from the anomaly. So, you know, of course, there's an h-bar in this coefficient, and this is an effective action and an effective stress tensor, which is some kind of expectation value of a quantum stress tensor. But I've already done the renormalization basically by these simple tricks. And so you get a finite effective action, and you get a finite renormalized stress tensor. So, yeah.
Just a remark. The conditions, yeah. You have the Hilbert condition, you have PQ. It's interesting. I don't know. It's just interesting, maybe just a coincidence. But these are exactly the Masher condition you get for Carrot boson, you know, compactified at sub-zero radius. So these are the Hilbert conditions for the string states you should put if you
compact. Both of these conditions?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Exactly the two.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, I guess you're putting those boundary conditions in a different way.
Yeah,
in that case.
Kind of,
yeah.
Yeah. You know, just the fact that these guys are vertex operators will give you that. In 1D,
Yeah. So one way or the other, you have to put boundary conditions to define what
so
you're doing.
Yeah. Only two solutions? That's what you're saying?
You know, if you assume that phi is only a function of R and linear in T, that's necessary in order to get a stress tensor which is time independent.
Okay.
I mean, if you do, you know, you can write more general solutions, but then you'll get general time dependent stress tensor. Okay.
Then. There's always T duality because it's
your
X and T.
Uh-huh.
Right? This is why you have these two sectors.
Okay. So this is, again, I dwell on the simple point. There's a lot, you know, I want to get to, but we'll see how far we get. But this is so simple that you can, you know, do its calculation on one page. And it already illustrates the features that are going to come out in four dimensions. Also, you know very well, if you've studied string theory or non-critical string theory in particular, that once you add this term to the action, just as I said here, the conformal mode becomes dynamical. This is another mode of the low energy theory. And how does that show up? It shows up that the conformal factor, which was constrained in the classical theory, is dynamical. And if you quantize this theory, in the bosonic string case, the C of the matter fields gets a minus 26 from the ghosts when you do the quantization in a covariant way, and that gets changed to minus 25, which is just picking up this one extra mode, and you know, this has been studied on the lattice and in many different ways. This gives a gravitational dressing of critical exponents at second order phase transition. So if the conformal theory I put there, or the theory I put there on a lattice, for example, is an Ising model, it has a certain central term, and if I put it on a random lattice and let the lattice also fluctuate, then I basically get dressing of the critical exponents as KPZ showed a long time ago, and that's verified on the lattice, and so. The moral is this is long distance physics. This is, you know, describing the critical exponents in a second order phase transition is basically telling you about long distance correlators. And And so there's non-trivial physics at long distances associated with this anomaly. Again, that's our theme about macroscopic effects and non-local infrared relevant operator in the effective field theory, and a massless degree of freedom that you have to take into account. So all of these lessons are the ones that come from the axial anomaly that we talked about yesterday, and as well as the 2D anomaly. So now let's go to four dimensions. Okay. In four dimensions, you see this P should be a pi squared. There is a well-known trace anomaly, first in a non-gravitational background, an electromagnetic background. And we actually looked at this again back in 2009. And again, you can, so it was known that the anomaly is there, that it's local, but nobody had bothered to look at the full stress tensor. It's more complicated, has more indices, so it's a bit of a tedious calculation, but you can do it, and you find that this amplitude, just like we were talking about yesterday with the triangle anomaly for the chiral current, this is a triangle anomaly, but with the chiral current replaced by the stress tensor. And so you again have to look at this triangle, and there are more invariants, there are more tensors that you have to keep track of, but basically almost all of them are traceless and have nothing to do with the anomaly, whereas one term, basically one structure, can be anomalous, and this is the function you have to look at. And this function, again, in the massless limit in which this the fermion or whatever particle is running around this loop is charged in this case because it's coupled to the currents. That function, again, has a 1 over k squared pole. And as we said yesterday, that corresponds in the imaginary part to a delta function in the center of mass variable. And so there is a massless scalar degree of freedom in the two-particle state here, too. Again, the difference from 2 to 4 dimensions is it's not the whole story. There are all these other terms, but you can isolate the one that has the anomaly. And secondly, you have to look at a more complicated diagram because this is quadratic in the field strength, so you have to go to a triangle. Okay, so I think you'll probably believe me. I won't go through this calculation. that's saying the same thing, essentially. Here's what the actual structure looks like if you put in a mass. There is a non-anomalous term which goes to zero with the mass going to zero, and you have the general spectral function, which again has this threshold-like behavior starting at 4m squared. So in other words, there is a finite sum rule, which you can just see by integrating this over s, which is independent of m and the other momenta invariants, p squared and q squared. The integral is finite, so what's happening as m goes to zero is that this is falling off more rapidly, but growing in height, and eventually becomes a delta function in the limit, because you have to satisfy this sum rule. So that's just the technicalities of it.
It's the limit of zero mass.
I'm sorry?
In the limit of zero mass.
In the limit of zero mass, yes. Basically, when all these invariants are small compared to the k squared coming in. Okay, so again, the picture that you get suggestively is that the pole at k squared equals zero describes a massless pair moving collinearly with opposite helicities. And this is, again, like a Cooper pair that we discussed yesterday. And I can replace this correlated two-particle state by a scalar field, and I can write an effective action for it because, in fact, again, like yesterday, this is asymmetric in the two sides, because T mu nu is not the same as F squared, and so you get some kind of off-diagonal propagator, like we saw yesterday, and you can write an effective action in terms of two fields. But this is a special case of the general form. So let me go to the general form is coming in the next slide, but already you can see something interesting has happened, right? Even before I go to fully gravitational interactions, just in the presence of electromagnetism in the standard model, you have some kind of effective state which is coupling to two photons. So if you just had the scalar tree graph, you know, think of this as a massive massive field here, or the sun, a classical massive object, then you would have an exchange of the gravitational quantum here, which gives you the ordinary classical forces and the bending of light, for example, in the background of this massive source. And if you look at you know, what's being exchanged here off shell, you're exchanging spin two fields, of course, which are gravitons propagating between the two sources. There are also scalar pieces, but those are non-propagating, like the Coulomb interaction and electromagnetism. But once I do this one loop calculation and replace this classical vertex by the loop, then this looks like the scalar propagator. And so you now have, at least in some kinematic limit, a coupling between the photons and the scalar part, which has a propagating mode. Okay, so there is a new mode in the low energy theory of gravity. And by the way, this is kind of interesting to think about what this might mean for deflection of light. Then you have to go to some classical limit, and since the anomaly decouples when these photons are on shell, or when they're, you know, low energy compared to the mass of the electron. So you really have to go to very high energies, MeVs. So it predicts, just in standard model, that there should be some deviation from the classical interaction of light with a massive source, but at very high energies, that would be very difficult to observe.
So, are you saying that this scalar mode is somehow the Coulomb field, which becomes dynamic?
Yeah, that's an analogy, a crude analogy. But roughly speaking, the constraints of electromagnetism become the constraints of gravity, and that makes the scale a part of the gravitational field non-propagating in the classical theory. But now the mode is propagating because it is inheriting the dynamics of whatever this scalar effective degree of freedom is from the two particle intermediate state here. We'll see it more explicitly. Okay? So now we get to what we really want to do, which is put this all together and see what it says for an effective theory of gravity. And so just, you know, again, reminding you of the general logic that if I try to classify all the relevant operators, I would basically stick to the strictly relevant terms in low energy theory, which are the cosmological and Einstein-Hilbert terms. But I'm now coupling this to quantum matter. And now I have the full form of the trace anomaly to contend with. And there is a more complicated effective action that this corresponds to, but which I'll show you in a minute. But this, leads to an additional term in the low energy theory, which is relevant, I would say, both technically and physically. Okay, the massless poles are the signature of that. So the calculation's a bit more complicated, but not too much. It takes a couple of pages rather than one. So basically, you classify these terms, the Weyl squared term, which is very simple, conformally invariant, went up to a root g. And this combination, which has very simple properties under conformal rescaling, and then put everything else into a box R here, which is actually not an anomaly, because this can be written as a variation of a local Lagrangian, which means you can remove it by a counter term. So B double prime is essentially arbitrary, but B and B prime are the true anomalies. Nowadays, I think this is Duff's notation, but nowadays these are called the A and C anomaly, I think. So this is the Euler-Gauss-Bonnet. There's always a topological-like term, which is a total derivative, and this is the Weyl invariant piece. That's all you have in 2D. So if you write the terms that way, the Weyl invariant piece is Weyl invariant. That's why it chose. And this combination turns out to be linear in sigma if I rescale by conformal rescaling, and that's why you write it this way. And And that means that, again, I can use this trick and say I have an effective a stress tensor trace, which has very simple properties. One is independent of sigma, and the other is linear in sigma. So I can immediately infer what the Gaussian effective viral invariant Vesemino action is for this, in order to give this right, this correct trace. And again, that means that I have viral invariant terms which are not determined by this if I integrate this up. And look what happens. A certain operator just necessarily appears geometrically from the Euler Gauss-Bonnet and the Box-R terms. You get a certain fourth order operator, which is just the analog of the simple operator Box in 2D. This operator is the unique scalar operator with four derivatives that scales covariantly, you know, up to root g, is invariant under conformal rescalings. So, yeah.
Gravity, unlike Maxwell's equations, gravity is not scale invariant, not conformally invariant. So these anomalous terms break the conformal symmetry.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about the Einstein-Hilbert term.
Yes,
yeah, the Einstein-Hilbert term is not entered in here yet. We're going to add it in the moment. But here I'm talking about conformal matter running around loops in a general background, which doesn't need to satisfy Einstein equation.
What happens when you tell us?
That's what I'm going to tell you, yeah. So this structure, you know, I didn't ask for it. I got it, okay? And yeah, I guess I should mention, you know, these calculations were done by Ronald Riegert, you know, back in the 80s. And that paper, I didn't get a lot of attention. And we discovered it later after we had done it again. So anyway, you can do all these tricks. You know, the arithmetic is a little bit more complicated, but again, not much, because again, this is a linear equation for sigma. So in principle, I can solve this for sigma by inverting this now fourth order operator, but it's still a linear wave equation. And then plug that value for sigma in here, and it's Gaussian, and so you get a non-local effective action, which looks like this. There's the E minus 2/3 box R at one point, x. There's the full anomaly at the other point, x prime. And there's the Green's function of this fourth order operator formally written this way, which of course is going to be tricky because it depends on boundary conditions. But formally, it has to be of this form. And then again, I can introduce a scalar field. In fact, I could introduce more than one, but if you take the simplest possibility and just complete the square here, then the simplest thing you can add is just one field. And again, it's linearly coupled to the anomaly and with the quadratic term that's governed by the delta 4 operator. And these coefficients, B and B prime, are known for free fields.
You've dropped some terms, right? Going from the first to the second.
From here to here?
Yeah, because it's not symmetric.
Yeah, it's not symmetric, so I could write it the minimal thing, and I have to add a particular viral invariant term, which completes the square, and since this is only determined up to viral invariant terms anyway, I can add that and just put that in the rest of the stuff that I don't know. Okay, yeah.
So, unlike in two dimensions, the Riegert operator, like the Laplacian, is fourth order in derivative, so this field, when it does become dynamical, isn't quite analogous to the Newton potential part of the gravitational field, right? Because that you'd expect.
Yeah, it's more complicated.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm gonna show you what happens when you linearize in various situations. Okay. Yeah.
Well, I mean, when it's flat, you have a double null pole for.
Yeah.
And then in the background. And
yeah. So you know the. The general questions here are still open, but we've analyzed this. Myself and other collaborators have analyzed various situations where something very simple happens, and I'll show you that. And you know, there are still questions. I don't claim that everything is completely solved.
But delta 4 does generally have four time derivatives.
Yes. It starts out its leading term, its principal term, is the wave operator squared. So it starts out as dt fourth.
There's potential instability.
There's potential issues, yes, indeed. Okay, and I think that's the main reason people didn't look at it. They got scared and said, you know, there's something wrong. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, if you made this up, then you would say, okay, it's probably something strange must happen and it may be a sick theory. But I started with just ordinary fields, you know, which are unitary. I couple them to gravity. And it's, so it's very hard to see why this theory should completely break down. And indeed, various cases that we've looked at, it passes. Let me show you. Let me get there, okay?
Sorry, the coefficients are the number of massless. N,
yeah.
S and F is, and V.
Yeah.
Massless scalars,
Dirac fermions,
yeah.
And
there is no minus signs in this.
There's no minus sign. There's, you know, these just by conventions, this has an overall minus.
There's no, but, to,
yeah, this
no,
is,
no specific way to cancel the number.
No. No, not. I mean, there are some exotic, more exotic theories and supersymmetric, supergravity theories where I think people have talked about different signs. But in all the, you know, if you don't put the gravitational fields in here themselves, then these have definite signs. And this is, you know, the fact that this has a definite sign is related to what's now called the A theorem, you know, so A or, yeah, which by the way, that's another interesting discussion. I mean, as to how you should actually prove it, I think involving these terms. But let's not go there. So now you can ask, okay, as
actually, let's go there.
You want to go there? All right. Okay.
People who do claim to prove the A theorem,
yeah,
don't use.
They don't.
Right.
Right.
So
I think it's incomplete.
I see.
I may
they
be
insist on a second order action.
Yeah, they have a kind of spontaneous symmetry breaking picture with a dilaton field and which is coupled only to the trace,
right.
And I think it's agreed that, you know, that's very suggestive, but is it? It's not a rigorous proof of the actual flow of that coefficient in quantum field theory language, which is what you know, they argue basically that's, well, because you need a spectral representation and to show that as you integrate out modes, you're basically always flowing in the same direction. So they're basically claiming from this picture that CUV and the UV and the ultraviolet and the infrared have to differ by a finite amount. You know, there are technical issues, but I think, frankly speaking, the way to prove it is to understand this structure and show that there is a positive spectral function, which, you know, and just, it's just a little scary because you've got this fourth order thing and you've got those complicated tensors.
Sure.
And so you've got to project out. I think the way to do it is to project out to the right tensor structure, which is actually going to show this flow, look at the right correlation function, and it should be rigorously proven. So I believe their statement is correct, but
the claim is correct. If you're right.
Well,
the claim is they've proven it.
Well, okay. Yeah. Now we get it. Now we get into questions of what's a proof, right? And you know, but for me, I'll just say, you know, straight out, it's to my understanding, it's not a complete proof
because the variables they use have a nonlinear. Action?
Yeah, because first of all, I think they would obviously say they've introduced an extra dilaton interaction, and they're not even trying to prove directly from the quantum field theory. I mean, this is just take quantum field theory. There's no dilaton here. I just take quantum field theory, look at stress tensor correlators, and project out the right correlation function. I should be able to prove this theorem if it's true. And that's not what they do.
No. The difference between theirs and yours is only quadratic, whereas theirs is,
yeah,
nonlinear.
Right.
They can't even attempt to analyze.
Right. Then they argue that you can put those terms to zero on shell, and, you know, so it gets. I'm happy to discuss this more, but you know, until I can prove it, I won't. Right. And then, of course, once you do all that work, they'll say they did it anyway. So, you know, yeah, that's a no-winner. But yeah, anyway.
It's because
They've been given prizes for it.
Right, they won't take back the prize,
they
right?
They won't give back the money.
But on the point of Horvagotsky and Schirmer's work, isn't their action just related to this one up to Fielder definition?
Well, basically they've mixed in the local term. You see, what I did here is I said it didn't concentrate on this because I don't care about it. I can just add a local term, R squared term, and that's not going to play any role in my discussion. Just add it if you want, but it just comes along for the ride. What they do is add a particular coefficient here in order to kill the fourth order term. And then because they don't like the fourth order term, and then they introduce a dilaton coupling, which only couples to the trace, and I think in order to really select out the right spectral function, you have to look at the full correlator and project onto the right. You know, this as we're gonna see, you know, explicitly, action produces a certain stress tensor and a certain definite, tensor structure, which I think you have to project out, because all the other stuff is not going to obey any particular simple spectral flow. That's always been the problem with these theorems that people tried for many years, is that in two dimensions there's only one thing that's there, it's unique, and sort of anything you write down has to be that. However, in higher dimensions there are these other terms which mix in, so you have operator mixing, you have pollution, and unless you project out exactly the right sector, you won't get the right answer. You won't get positivity.
The dilaton coupling though, so that is the assumption that that you're basically measuring couplings of the dilaton with other fields in units of the coefficient of the kinetic term, the dilaton, so it's like the decay constant. And you're saying here in principle you should keep that to be order one or something throughout, that you don't actually make the...
I don't know what that dilaton is. It doesn't... I mean, so they have a completely different picture.
Dealing with the non-covariant version of that action by treating the physical metric as the one that's stressed, as in the e power 2 sigma g, and then calling sigma the dilaton.
It's very closely related to that, right? From my point of view, you see what I said here is that this action, where is it? This action is not covariant.
Right. Yeah.
Because I've chosen to break up the metric in some arbitrary way and look at the conformal fiber of it, and that's a convenient way to do the calculation. But I'm not satisfied with this action. I want to write a covariant action, and then I write this other forms of it. So what they do is say, well, let's just treat sigma as a real bona fide field itself. Call it a dilaton or whatever you want, and then adjust the local terms. And so it's a completely different philosophy, and obviously the formulas that look very similar, but it's a completely different philosophy because if sigma is really part of the metric, you're not allowed to treat that as a separate field in a covariant language.
Right, because they think that you could shift it and then you could do a wild transformation, keeping G fixed in some sense.
Yeah. So as you see, I've looked at this. I have an opinion, but you know, this is going to get us into. I mean, those technical details, I think, should be.
Question. You mentioned briefly the property of delta four. So it's like it depends on the metric, and is it that if you rescale the metric, you get delta four plus violent?
That's what I said. That it's invariant.
Or it's just completely invariant.
It's covariant.
Yeah.
In other words, it's a it's a density. So this combination. Is completely invariant.
Good.
And that, of course, is the analog
to
this statement in 2D.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, and it's the only operator that has that property, fourth order. Okay, this is also telling you, just as a remark, we won't get to the end, but that's fine. We'll just stop at some point, and we can go on later if you want. But you see that, again, there's a topological structure here This thing is a topological invariant, so it's like FF dual in the chiral case, but now we're talking about geometrical topological invariants, the Euler number of the manifold. So you know, all of this is very intricate structure, which, you know, I think was kind of discovered more or less by just, you know, playing with it, just by hand. But it's clearly indicative of a much more of a deeper geometrical structure, and it's been extended to higher even dimensions. There's always seems to be always true that you can take, there are more and more, there's always one topological term, and there are more and more Weyl invariant terms as you go to higher dimensions, but you can always choose a certain combination of the trivial term and the topological term, which is linear in sigma. So that's been shown in 6 and I think even in 8. So there's some interesting differential geometry here, you know, related to uniformization of manifolds in higher dimensions.
So is delta 4 a Casimir?
Sorry?
Is delta 4 a Casimir? Conformal Casimir?
Casimir in what sense? I mean, it is invariant. So I guess, yeah, the eigenvalues of that operator, yeah. Are conformally invariant. Yeah.
Does it factorize into the product of two?
It does in certain backgrounds.
I meant generally.
Generally, no.
Not obvious.
No. This can also be written as I can pull a derivative on one side and the derivative, it must be a total derivative. I think I have it on one of the slides. So you can write this as d mu something, d nu on the other side. But it doesn't in general factorize. It factorizes in a conformally flat space, and it factorizes in some other special cases. I think conformal flatness is basically what you need. It clearly factorizes in flat space, because all these terms are zero. All right. So good. That's great. Ask all these questions. But the basic argument for why there are many ways to look at this, but we basically argued some years ago that you can always decompose the 1PI quantum effective action of any quantum field theory in a background geometry. Think of integrating out any number of quantum fields of any masses, anything you like, as long as they're well-defined quantum field theories. Then basically the exact quantum effective action can always be expressed as a sum of terms, local terms, which, you know, get renormalized if you're going to define a finite effective theory. And so the local terms, of course, must start out with the Einstein-Hilbert term, cosmological term, and additional more complicated higher order invariants. This is what people usually consider when they talk about quantum gravity corrections back in the 70s and 80s. But, you know, just from simple power counting, you can see these are going to involve higher derivatives of local terms, and so they're not going to be relevant at any scales except at the Planck scale. So you're not going to do the full quantum theory of gravity this way, but in an effective approach, these terms should be neglected, I would say, at ordinary scales, non-Planckian scales. But then you have from this anomaly term, you can basically divide the remaining terms, which are non-local in general, in terms of the anomalous term. You classify them by how they scale, basically, according to the Weyl group. So we have the Weyl invariant terms. These are what I call the integration constants. When I solve for the anomalous action, I found the sigma variation of it. But of course, I was insensitive to the sigma independent terms, and those are all general Weyl invariant terms, which can be very complicated and definitely are non-zero in particular cases, but they're neutral under Weyl scalings. So you might call these marginally irrelevant, whereas the S anomaly scales linearly with sigma, as we saw, which means, since, you know, the metric is e to the 2 sigma, that means that it scales logarithmically with distance. And this can be relevant at large distance scales. It's logarithmic behavior, which means it's marginally relevant. And this is a very special term as well, because the Vesemino consistency condition does relate, after all, this came from looking at sigma and doing these little tricks. And so, not surprisingly, if I rescale the metric and keep phi fixed, that is equivalent to shifting phi and taking this difference, and here putting phi equals 2 sigma. So it's a very tight relation, which prevents you from adding any arbitrary terms in phi, because it will not generally satisfy this Vesemino consistency, which is just a statement that there must be a covariant effective action corresponding to this anomaly. Okay, so yeah.
Follow your argument that the phi invariants were marginally irrelevant.
Well, it's a term. I mean, basically, they're vial neutral. They're neutral under rescalings. So. It means that there's no way for them to grow at large distances. So whatever they are at any scale, they're fixed. Okay. Whereas this can be, this is what we said back in 2001 and 2, and everything, all the calculations are consistent with this so far, and it means that. We think, okay, and it's a hypothesis and can be checked in various cases, that this, in addition to the obviously relevant terms, the S anomaly should definitely be kept in the low energy effective theory, and we might therefore define an effective theory just in terms of this anomaly plus the relevant terms, and then just see case by case whether this matters. So we've looked at that. They're definitely scaled differently. That's the only statement I have here.
The question might just be, why is it not just that, well, if it's a full quantum effective action, then that should be the exactly marginal terms, or the, if you integrate out of the fields, then that's the part of the effective action that the exactly marginal terms should contribute, or the completely wild invariant ones.
Yes.
So, only the vicinity of a fixed point. Is there a sense in which marginally irrelevant is meaningful, right? Otherwise, it's just irrelevant ones.
So we're obviously trying to extend the Wilsonian kind of classification to a gravitational situation, and it suggests that from all the experience that these are the important terms that you should keep, and you don't need these. I mean, there's no reason, for example, for these terms to generate a massless pole. I mean, if you look in detailed calculations, there are vial invariant terms, but they're very complicated. They're all this, logarithmic, dilogarithms, all kinds of usual branch structure that field theories generate, but never an isolated pole. That seems to be very special to all these anomalous amplitudes. So it's a suggestion I would say that we definitely should keep this. Now, whether these terms are important in which cases, you have to investigate case by case. That's all I can, I don't have a proof, right, that you should neglect this all the time. It's suggestive, though, right? Yeah.
There's probably the Vesemino consistency. The reason why you need to put descendants of phi is like Sn log on phi in your action. There's no higher derivative term in phi.
Right. What higher derivative term?
You have a function here. In the local terms, you could have local. Okay. No, in the next slide.
Next slide. Yeah. Oh, you want to add?
Well, I'm
asking. I'm saying that phi was introduced in a very particular way. And if it satisfies this Vesemino consistency condition, basically almost any term you think of writing down is not going to satisfy it. Yeah. Yeah. No. I mean, of course, here the simplest calculation is done in conformal theories, which have no scale. But if you go and look at those details and put in a mass, then you see again the same behavior, decoupling at high mass, and so it's just the energy of those lines, the external lines, compared to the mass. Okay, but none of this involved, for example, Newton's constant or the Planck scale. Newton's constant enters only through the classical action, but not through the anomaly. So when I put them all together, then of course there will be a competition, and that scale will enter any prediction. but the anomaly by itself has no such scale. Yeah, but I don't see that here in the quantum field theory, unless I put it in a medium or do something more complicated, like we were discussing yesterday. That has not been touched, actually, in this case. So it's completely open. What happens to this field if it's propagating, you know, through a block of matter? And so, you know, there are a lot of questions, but this is basically just I'm telling you what I know so far. Okay, so basically we argue, therefore, that the effect of action, because it scales logarithmically, is marginally relevant according to the classical scaling dimensions. It's not given in terms of the local curvature purely. So it's a very different sort of quantum correction than the ones that people generally considered, and therefore could be considered, if nothing else, an effective theory which could modify general relativity and maybe worth studying because it has some motivation coming from quantum corrections in a very natural way. So, you know, you can take different attitudes. You can say, well, you know, this is really generated by standard model fields, and it is. Or you could say, I don't know where it comes from. The coefficients here, b and b prime, could be arbitrary, but why shouldn't I not consider this term as a relevant term in the effective action and see what effects it has?
So here is the effective action after you integrate all the matter, or?
Yeah, I mean, either derive it from integrating out the matter and think of this as a 1PI action, or just say, you know, I'm agnostic about the matter. I just want to write down an effective theory in the gravitational sector, and I know that these kind of terms will be generated, so why not add them from the beginning?
Can I have an argument of how phi would couple to matter, if it does couple to
sure.
matter?
Or sure. The, well, the coupling. The coupling is constrained.
Identity,
yeah, I think the coupling is constrained here. I mean, basically, delta 4 phi is sourced by the anomaly in all possible terms.
That's the only coupling.
Yeah. Okay. That's the only one that I can write down that's consistent with S-amino consistency. I mean, you're welcome to try. I mean, if I put other terms, it usually doesn't work. So, by the way, that's of course important if you think about this from a phenomenological point of view, because these terms are typically very small in our local neighborhood, for example. So when people look at Brans-Dickey-like theories, you know, you have these parameters. A coupling which couples to the trace of the classical stress tensor, and the classical stress tensor can be large, and so you can get large effects in the solar system or in terrestrial experiments. But here, these coefficients are fixed by, if I view this as coming from an effective integration of matter fields, these coefficients are fixed, they're dimensionless, there's no scale, and these terms you have to look at are fairly small. I mean, we'll look at it now in a moment for different situations, but certainly the curvature invariants are very tiny, and the only real effects that could be associated with this on interesting astrophysical environments are associated with the electromagnetic anomaly and the gluonic anomaly of QCD, because then I can source this term by something more significant than these tiny gravitational terms.
Okay. Do you know if it plays a role in this non-derivative algae techniques, and this non-motion fixed points like these?
Yeah.
How does that?
Well,
you usually don't consider these terms. So
that's right.
Is that so?
That's right. So, you know, the folks who are doing the RG program.
Yeah.
I've tried to convince them that they should put this in, but they haven't, as far as I know.
Okay.
The functional renormalization group program.
Yeah.
You know that
non-perturbative.
Martin Reuter and others discussed, and you have people here. Is anyone here doing it now?
Asymptotic safety.
Yeah. So I've suggested that they should put that term in and see how that affects the RG flow. But as far as I know, it hasn't been done.
I mean, this term seems to make
good sense in the Euclidean. They do everything Euclidean.
So yeah. Yeah.
Is it positive, this term?
Yeah.
Positive Euclidean action.
Yes, because I think I have the signs right, B prime, and just take it to be minus B prime to be positive, then yeah, it's a positive Euclidean action.
If you look at the numbers of this, say, four is the source, fine. So what energy, where would you actually see this?
I'm trying to get to it. Be more patient, but we may be stopped. I'm out of time. So you should tell me what to do.
Somewhat relaxed about that.
Yeah, but you have another. You have another speaker, I think. You have another speaker, and he's only here this week. Yeah. So you tell me. You know, I'm. Your wish is my command. Tell me what to do. Yeah. Yeah.
Can you tell us what you have?
Can I have another session?
Yeah. Okay. So yeah. Let me just put. I wanted to.
I think another session would be best, right? You have a lot more.
Yeah, another session.
Well, yeah. So this is all the theoretical background and framework, and now comes the applications that we've done so far, and I'll just tell you what they are, and then if you want to hear more. So that's what the stress tensor looks like. I was amazed because you know this looks like some kind of Egyptian papyrus, right? There's like, what's that?
Maybe they knew it already.
maybe you'll discover it in the Babylonian cuneiform tablet. So I shouldn't show this slide, but it's kind of fun just to see. You can write it down. Okay, so it's known, and there's nothing there than derivatives and curvatures. Okay, in flat space. So I was going to next talk about linearizing this theory around flat space and just verify the statement I made that there are scalar gravitational waves on what situation, and you know, this is the analysis of those waves, of the power that they generate, of the size of those effects based on the anomaly. You know, I can't go through it. And you know, we looked at, or I looked at the case of very strong magnetic fields, turns out to be still too small for LIGO, for example. But in the gluonic sector, you can have a fairly large, you know, 10 orders of magnitude larger source of the QCD anomaly, which we know is there by the running of the strong coupling constant. And if you have gluonic condensate, for example, inside neutron stars, and you smash them together in like the binary merger we've seen just recently from LIGO, then you can use this as a back of the envelope estimate for how big the gravitational waves in the scalar sector would be, and we did that calculation. You know, well, it's an estimate; it's not a real calculation. In order to do a better job, we'd need to actually, you know, model the neutron star equation of state, but this does give, I don't know if I have it on the slide here or not, it gives something which is quite a bit larger than this, and within detectability, I should put that on the slide. It's possibly observable neutron star mergers. That's the quick answer. So
no, there's a minus sign in your anomaly.
Where? You're worried about minus signs.
Before it was always adding up. There's a screening.
I thought you were going to tell me, you know, there's a minus sign error here. In this.
I'm talking about the possibility of screening or anti-screening of the anomaly.
Yeah. No, I mean that's just the sign of the phase of the gravitational wave. That's not.
Later.
The power is positive.
Can we?
Yeah.
Can we maybe just do that next week?
Yeah. And then I was going to talk about what the stress tensor does in black hole backgrounds. That's what I was going to talk about.
Wednesday or Thursday.
Fine with me. Just fix the time and don't change it. Or you're to blame. Yeah.
Okay, let's
Should I
we'll do that.
So thank you.